Thank you. Thank you all for inviting me. I want to thank Keith for inviting me. I didn't even realize you all were doing this. I had such a meeting in such a beautiful place. Yesterday, I walked around this beautiful town, went and bought some cannabis, and people were lovely. He's like, damn. I don't know if black people around the country know that you all live like this. Shit. It's like, damn, you all kept this a secret. Anyway, I'm just happy to be here with some of my friends. Paul, my dear friend Paul, whenever I have a cannabis question, I always call Paul, and he always helps me out, and it makes me seem smarter than I am. So thank you, Paul. So my talk is a little different. It's called How Pot and Other Recreational Drugs Can Cure Racism. I think we lost the screen for a second. Nah, it's just that I pulled on the cord too tight, I think. Yeah. Is it?
It kind of takes a second.
All right. Perfect, man. Thank you. No, I know you can hear me, but it's more than hear me. When you give a good presentation, it's about the sort of visual effects as well. You have to have a variety of a media. Otherwise, the shit is boring. And I didn't come here to bore you. And that's not what I do. I don't bore you. I assure you that. So this title is a play on some of the things that have been annoying me. I get reports sometimes about how marijuana can cure everything from cancer to Ebola. And then so I thought, well, why not cure racism? And so that's what this talk is dealing with. Now, I should give you guys some background of who I am. This is me in the lab back in the day when I was idealistic, thinking that I was going to use neuroscience as a way to cure drug addiction. You see, I thought that drug addiction was the biggest problem that faced communities from which I came, particularly some black communities in the United States, because we were told that the problems were related to drugs and drug addiction. And so I figured that I can make my contribution through neuroscience, understand the neurobiological mechanisms that are responsible for drug addiction, therefore cure it, solve it, and you solve the crime and the poverty in my community. And so I set out to do that. This is one of my first publications. This is a publication entitled Nicotine's Effects on Dopamine Clearance in Rat Nucleus Accumbens. So basically what we were doing was we were putting probes in rat in this portion of the brain called the nucleus accumbens. We thought the nucleus accumbens was important for reward and drug addiction. If we understood dopamine in this region, we thought that we would be able to solve drug addiction. And these are some of the other sort of brain regions that are responsible or involved. The ventral tegmental area that projects to the prefrontal cortex, it projects also to the nucleus accumbens and to the amygdala. And we went about trying to study these various brain areas. And so for the past 20 years or so, I've been publishing papers testing various drugs to see whether or not they impacted, decreased, stop people from taking cocaine, crack cocaine specifically. We bring people into the lab. We maintain them on some drug based on this neurobiological theory, disrupting this pathway. If we could block this pathway, we can prevent cocaine from having its euphoric and its gripping effects on people. Now, we published dozens of papers under this sort of theory, tested a variety of drugs under this theory, and we were unsuccessful. I was a failure. I had spent 20 years of publishing negative data. I was a failure. And it's not cool feeling like a failure. So I had to take a step back. And as I took a step back, I wrote the book High Price. In writing High Price, it forced me to think about what was really going on, what had really happened. It forced me to question the assumptions under which I was dealing. Now, in the process of writing High Price, I learned some very important things, more important things than I was learning when I was in the lab looking at dopamine, in the lab trying to apply this theory. I had to come out of the lab, the weeds, if you were. I was in the weeds. High Price forced me to come out and look at the trees. And so now what I want to share with you all is some of the things that I learned while looking at the trees and not the weeds. One of the first things that I learned is that drugs are not the problem. I thought drugs were the problem. Drugs are not the problem, because most of the people who use drugs don't have a problem. 75 to 90% of people who use drugs like crack cocaine, heroin, you name it, marijuana, you name it, don't have a problem. They are responsible people. They are me. I'm a heroin user. I'm an MDMA user. I am a drug user. I'm a responsible person. I take care of my family. I pay my bills. I take care of my taxes. I'm not different from these guys. These guys were drug users. Bill Clinton, of course, used marijuana. George Bush acknowledges using marijuana, but he's widely suspected of using cocaine, has not acknowledged that yet, so I can't say what I know, but I can't say it. Whereas Barack Obama has acknowledged using marijuana and cocaine. Now, the goal here is not to tarnish these guys' reputation. They are quite capable of doing that themselves. And they have done that themselves. That's not my goal. The goal here is to point out that these guys represent the rule and not the exception. Now, another lesson I learned was that we in science, me, along with other people in our society, of course, follow suit. We have exaggerated the harmful effects of drugs. That's what we do. We specialize in exaggerating the harmful effects of drugs. And I'll tell you why in a second. But first, I want to tell you how. This is a picture of powder cocaine on the left and crack cocaine on the right. This is just the chemical structure. Focus your attention on the left, the red circle. That's the only difference between these two compounds. The red circle is a hydrochloride portion. That's a salt. It keeps the compound stable such that you can't smoke it. If you want to smoke it, you have to remove that red portion, the hydrochloride portion. You can remove it simply by dissolving it in water and baking soda, heating it up, and bringing it back, and then the salt is gone. Now you have crack. They're the same drug pharmacologically. They have the exact same effect. It's true, when you smoke crack cocaine, the effects are more rapid, more intense than when you snort powder cocaine. But when you dissolve powder cocaine in water, shoot it intravenously, you get the same rapid onset of effects and the same intense effects as smoking crack cocaine. They are the same drug. The scientific literature knows this. This is a picture of methamphetamine and amphetamine. Amphetamine is on the left, methamphetamine is on the right. This is a paper one of my PhD students at the time did for his dissertation, a part of his dissertation. Amphetamine, of course, you all know the drug Adderall. Everybody knows Adderall? Adderall. That's amphetamine is the active ingredient in Adderall. Adderall has three amphetamines, but only one of them is really what we are seeking, the D portion that crosses the blood-brain barrier well. That's amphetamine. That's on the left. On the right, that's methamphetamine. You can see the only difference between these two compounds is the additional methyl group that's in the red circle on the right. That additional methyl group was said in the scientific literature, still said in the scientific literature, that additional methyl group makes methamphetamine more lipid soluble, meaning that it crosses the blood-brain barrier more rapidly. It has more intense effects. It's more addictive. It's more dangerous. You add the adjective. That's what's been said in the scientific literature. But when you go and look at the literature, the studies that have compared the two drugs under double-blind conditions in people, starting in 1971, Billy Martin and his group did this. They compared the two drugs under double-blind condition. The drugs produce identical effects. This is at the oral administration. These findings were replicated by Rick Lamb and Jack Henningfield in 1994, replicated further in 2009 by a guy named Craig Rush. And in 2012, we extended it by using larger intranasal doses. And what we found was that methamphetamine and amphetamine are essentially the same drug. Both of these drugs were used widely in World War II. Our military still uses amphetamine for soldiers to keep them awake, help them fight longer, and hopefully better. But they are the same drugs, although we have a different verbal behavior surrounding methamphetamine in the country. They are the same drug. All of the scientific literature in humans support that. Okay, let's stay with methamphetamine. Other sort of exaggerations that have been said about methamphetamine. If you ever go to scientific talks, and I don't encourage you to do so, but if you do, if you go to scientific talks, oftentimes you will see someone put up a brain imaging slide like this. This is a brain imaging slide, a PET imaging slide. You get PET imaging by simply injecting a radioactive compound in the person's body. That radioactive compound, in a case like this, would be something that selectively binds to dopamine receptors. In this case, the drug is racloparide. It binds. It's a radioactive racloparide. It binds to receptors in the brain, and it lights up. And we see the lighting up in this photograph. And what a researcher would tell you in a talk like this, they say, okay, focus your attention on the left, that's the brain of someone who didn't take methamphetamine. Focus your attention on the right, that's the brain of someone who has abused methamphetamine for many years. You, the audience, you're smart. You can clearly see the difference. Yes? Okay, these are not data. These are pictures that are reproduced with fancy statistical techniques. And the lab under which the studies are done selects the color scheme and the intensity. That's why you can't really replicate these sorts of things. So this is not data. You will ask people to show you data. This tells you nothing. It tells you absolutely nothing. But it's a pretty picture. And this is how we fool people. Now, I can image this side of the room versus that side of the room. And we can find some differences that we can highlight. But what we would not do is to say that one side is cognitively impaired or brain damaged compared to the other side based on those differences. But in the scientific literature, that's essentially what has been done. And so this concerned me so much. I published a paper, a critical review of that literature in 2012. All of the literature that had did brain imaging with methamphetamine users and cognitive testing with methamphetamine users. And what I found was this. I found that the cognitive functioning of methamphetamine users were average, in the normal range, when you included the appropriate controls. The appropriate controls are simple. You compare the cognitive performance of the methamphetamine users with that of people of the same age, people of the same educational background. When you do that, you find that these people perform in the average or the normal range. What happens in the literature is that sometimes they compared high school graduates who were methamphetamine users with college graduates who were not methamphetamine users. And they found the high school methamphetamine users performed more poorly on some tasks than the college graduates. No shit. That's what you would expect. But when you have the proper controls, overwhelmingly, they perform in the normal range. And then when you look at the brain imaging in this literature, look at the brain imaging, any difference between those groups were interpreted as clinically significant pathology, which is inappropriate because there is a wide range of human variability in brain measures, in the size of people's brain structures. Everybody with me? Right on. Yeah, that's a great question. The question is that these papers are supposed to be peer-reviewed. They all are peer-reviewed. Now, you have to understand, so the people who will be reviewing these papers are also in that area. And they also have skin in the game in making sure that these kind of findings are reported. Because the journals also don't necessarily want to publish a paper with no findings. I mean, I have built a career on negative findings, but that's a difficult thing to do. But I will get to the motivation in a second. But thank you. That was a great question. So let's go to now. That was methamphetamine. Let's think about marijuana, something that many people in the room have some experience with. The same thing happens with marijuana. This was a paper published in the Journal of Neuroscience, one of our better journals. And the authors concluded that the results from this study indicate that young recreational marijuana users, there is structural abnormalities in the nucleus accumbens and the amygdala. This is what they reported. There were structural abnormalities in these young people who smoked marijuana. Now, when you think about that conclusion, one of the things that you want to make sure people have whenever they do brain imaging is that they have corresponding behavioral outputs, that is cognitive testing or something else, not just the brain imaging, because brains can look different for a variety of reasons, but they perform similarly. Let's think about basketball players. There are basketball players who are 6 feet tall, and they can outjump other basketball players who are 7 feet tall. That's just how it is. Now, one of the things with the brain, a similar sort of thing can happen. Because your sort of structure is not as big as the other person's structure doesn't mean that it's not functioning as well or even better. It just means that that's within the normal range of human variability. But in the literature, it's been interpreted as bigger is better than smaller. And that's inappropriate. So these folks, for this particular study, did not have any cognitive functioning or any other behavioral output, none of that, and they just interpreted any difference as clinical impairments. Now, when you think about the participants in this study, the participants in this study were college students who smoked maybe three times a week. That's relatively low amounts of smoking. And they attributed these horrible abnormalities to this relatively light using group. And they published it in one of our top journals. This is the state of drug abuse research, because we want to make sure we find something negative. Now, this also sets us up to this issue of reefer madness. We have today a more sophisticated way of thinking about reefer madness. Some of you all remember reefer madness. I know some of you all look like you were there. Some of you all remember reefer madness, right? I just want to remind you all of just a clip. I have a short clip of Reefer Madness, and I want to just to remind us of what happened during that era. Here's a short clip. So we laugh. We laugh now at this sort of thing, but it's back. It's with us. It's with us today when we think about the notion that cannabis causes people to be psychotic or schizophrenic. This has come back in a strong way, particularly in Europe, the UK. In fact, the journal The Lancet, which is one of the world's best medical journals, they have essentially become the marijuana causes psychosis journal. Now, this disturbed us. My co-author, Charlie Kassir, and I, we did a literature review this past year we published on this situation. We wanted to see how strong the relationships were in terms of cannabis' role in psychosis. And what we concluded was this. We concluded that the correlation between cannabis and psychosis is not specific to a chemical like THC. That is, when you look at things like tobacco use, nicotine, or amphetamine use, other drugs, other chemicals, those relationships oftentimes are stronger than the cannabis relationship. That's one. Another thing is that the cannabis psychosis relationship is not specific to that disorder. When you look at something like anxiety, depression, and other disorders, you see that there are also relationships. And so you can't talk about cannabis psychosis linked without talking about these other factors. If someone is simply talking about the link between cannabis and psychosis without talking about nicotine, without talking about amphetamine, without talking about other psychiatric illnesses, that's a license for you to stop listening because they think you are an idiot or they are an idiot. And also, you can't forget this point. In our study, what we found too was that the link between cannabis and cat ownership, the link between psychosis and cat ownership as a child is equally strong. There have been papers to replicate this. Not to say that cat ownership causes psychosis, but it just gives you an idea of correlation is not causation. And it helps people to think through these things more carefully, I hope. Now, as we think about this exaggeration that we have participated in science and our society, one has to ask, well, why would people exaggerate? You know, like what would motivate people to exaggerate? Well, you exaggerate in part because it helps to increase your budget. Oftentimes we have heard people say, particularly in the past 5-10 years or so,
that the war on drugs has been a huge failure. That is the biggest bullshit. The war on drugs has been a tremendous success. It's been a failure for most of the American people, but the people who are waging the war, it has been hugely successful. It has increased the budgets of law enforcement personnel. People who provide treatment, it has increased their budget. Obama recently announced that he would release $1 billion to help with the so-called heroin epidemic. I'll talk about that in a second. Treatment providers will get a large portion of that money. Politicians, they benefit so much so because they pretend to deal with real problems simply by saying we're going to rid the community of drugs or we're going to be tougher on drugs. And you, the public, say, yeah, they're doing their job. They're not. That's a distraction. The media, of course, they benefit because they have stories, salacious stories that sell. Documentary filmmakers benefit. Filmmakers benefit. Most of the films and documentaries on drugs are so wrong. They are so infuriating. And we watch them. I've been in a couple, and I've been infuriated by the ones I have been in. Scientists benefit. I have built a career. I'm a full professor now as a result of studying drugs, in large part under the same sort of misguided way that I am lamenting here today. Another reason, it allows us as a society not to deal with the real problems that people on the margins face. Unemployment, substandard education, poor nutrition, ignorance. It allows us not to deal with those issues because we can say, we're going to rid that community of drugs. Never mind that unemployment in that community is 50%. But we're going after drugs. It also allows us to target people that we don't like without explicitly saying so. Until Donald Trump came along, of course. But it allows us to go after these folks without saying so. And that takes me to my next point. Racial discrimination has been rampant in the enforcement of drugs. Now, as I give this talk to you all because I want you all to make the connection between what we have been saying about cannabis, and you know that's largely rubbish. You know it. If you know what we've been saying about cannabis, the exaggeration is rubbish, why don't you think what we've been saying about heroin is rubbish? Why don't you think what we've been saying about methamphetamine or crack cocaine is rubbish? The same thing. So I'm asking you all to use your critical thinking and apply it more broadly. Now, when I talk about racial discrimination, I am not talking about what's in your head. I don't care what's in your head. I'm talking about actions that result in disproportionately unjust or unfair treatment of persons of specific racial groups. These are actions, not prejudice. I'm not talking about racial disparities. Disparities are simply differences. And when we think about disparity, for example, this is a generalization, of course, but white people smoke Marlboro cigarettes. Black people like to smoke Newport. That's a racial disparity. That's not discrimination. What I'm talking about is action, racial discrimination. And as I pointed out, intent here is not necessarily. Whether you meant to do it or not doesn't even matter. It's the action. It's the result. Now, that doesn't mean that you are a bad person. This has nothing to do about whether people are bad or good people, because we all make mistakes. And that's okay. It's part of being an American. We make our mistakes and we own it and we get better. So I'm not talking about intent. Now that we understand what I mean when I talk about racial discrimination, by the way, I'm using racial discrimination interchangeably with racism. Now, when I think about drugs in our country and the enforcement of drugs, one of the more egregious sort of examples of this has to do with the 1986-1988 laws that punished crack cocaine 100 times more harshly than powder cocaine. In effect, what it meant was that people caught with small amounts of crack cocaine were required to go to jail for a mandatory minimum sentence of 5 years, whereas to trigger the same sentence for powder cocaine, you had to have 100 times more powder cocaine. Now, what happened with this case was that we found that more than 80% of the people prosecuted at the federal level under this law were black. More than 80% of the people prosecuted and convicted. Now, black people didn't make up the majority of the crack users, although if you watch your evening news, you would get a different impression. Now, this concerned the U.S. public. It concerned Congress. It concerned the president. So they directed the U.S. Sentencing Commission to do a study. And the Sentencing Commission did a study, and they found these horrible numbers. In fact, they found in 1 year, I think 1992, L.A. County, the entire L.A. County, they had arrested over and prosecuted over 1,000 people for crack cocaine offenses. Not one was white. This is L.A. County. This is not Detroit. This is L.A. County. So the Sentencing Commission said, something's wrong. We got it wrong. They submitted to Congress in 94 their report saying that we should equate the two and we should really check out how we're enforcing this law. Congress, for the first time in the U.S. Sentencing Commission's history, rejected their recommendation. And Bill Clinton agreed with Congress, and he too rejected that recommendation. Bill Clinton said that he had to send a constant message to our children that drugs are illegal, drugs are dangerous, and drugs may cost you your life. And the penalty for dealing drugs are severe. So Bill Clinton said, no. He said no. Fast forward 12 years later. Along comes presidential candidate Barack Obama speaking before Howard University, a black audience. He said that about this law, judges think that's wrong, Republicans think that's wrong, Democrats think that's wrong, and yet it's been approved by Republican and Democratic presidents because no one has been willing to brave the politics and make it right. That will change when I'm president. Did that change? Well, in the Obama way, kind of, right? Kind of. In 2010, he signed legislation that decreased the disparity from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1. Now, recall, please, when I pointed out and I showed you that crack and powder are essentially the same drug, it would be like punishing people who smoked cannabis 18 times more harshly than those who chewed it in their brownies. So recall that. Now, I think Brother Malcolm X spoke to this issue best posthumously when he said, if you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there is no progress. That's essentially what we did. Do I have 10 minutes? Do we? Right on. I'll be done in 10 minutes. Right on. So Malcolm X, I agree with Malcolm X's comments. Particularly when we think about, these are data from 2015 from the federal government. Even today, 80% of the people who are prosecuted under these laws are black. Today. All right. So now let's talk about heroin just briefly, because the country is in the midst of losing its mind about this so-called epidemic. But before talking about heroin, I think that I'd like to have the mayor of Maine, LePage, I'd like to have him kind of tell us how the American people see this.
Governor LePage was talking about out-of-state drug dealers coming to Maine in response to a question. It's a topic he discusses at a lot of town hall forums. Here's what he said last night.
The traffickers, these are in the pig traffickers. These are guys that name D-Money, Smoothie, Shifty, these type of guys. Connecticut, New York. They come up here, they sell their heroin, then they go back home. Incidentally, half the time they impregnate a young white girl, which is real sad. But then we have another issue that we've got to deal with down the road.
Well, That was that was 2 months ago, about 2 months ago. So I mean, I think this, he encapsulate what and how we've been dealing with drugs in the country. Most of us are not stupid enough to say it, but thank God for stupid politicians. It encapsulates how we in the country have been behaving. Whether we want to deny it or not, the evidence is clear. These are the people, by the way, who we are arresting for heroin, even though the face of the user is white. But these are the people, Google it. You check out heroin arrests throughout the country every day. These are the folks who are being arrested. Now, we think about marijuana. I'm going to just kind of wrap it up. I just want to just say marijuana, similar sort of racial discrimination is going on. At the state level, black people are 4 times more likely to be arrested. At the federal level, Hispanics represent 2/3 of all of those arrested for marijuana, even though all groups use it at similar rates. This, of course, is a clear example of racism, racial discrimination, not racial disparity. Don't soften it. Call it what it is. And this is happening with marijuana. So you can imagine how it's happening with everything else. Now, before closing up, I want to ask you all, do you all know what these three people have in common? Ramarlee Graham, Trayvon Martin, Sandra Bland. Marijuana played a role in all of their death. Ramarlee Graham was a young kid, 18-year-old, kid on the corner, suspected of selling marijuana. Chased into his grandmother's bathroom and shot to death because the officer said that he was flushing the marijuana down the toilet. The officer was not prosecuted. Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman, said that Trayvon Martin attacked him because Trayvon Martin was high on marijuana. Now, I wrote a New York Times piece showing that the levels that Trayvon Martin had in his system were placebo-like. That didn't matter. George Zimmerman's defense was at least partially persuasive because he got off. Sandra Bland was a young woman who was pulled over for a traffic violation, got into a tussle with the police officer and sent to jail, and then found hanging in her jail 2 days later. They said that she was either intoxicated during the interaction with the police, or she had snuck some marijuana in her cell and took such large doses that it made her commit suicide. All of this, of course, is incredible. Incredible being unbelievable. But these are the kinds of things that are said about drugs in our society, which is just simply inconsistent with logic. And I didn't tell you that what I do as a, for a job is that I give people drugs and I test their effects. And I have given thousands of doses of drugs like crack cocaine, marijuana, methamphetamine. Never have I seen these incredible effects that people describe, that law enforcement officials describe when things go wrong. Never. So I was going to show you a clip of Sandra Bland, but that would take too long. I want to just make sure we wrap up. Now, these are the horrifying statistics that keep me up at night. Blacks represent 1/3 of all the people who are arrested for drugs, even though they use drugs at similar rates as their counterparts. 1 in 3 black boys can expect to spend some time in prison if we don't change the way we're doing things. Black males represent 6% of the general population, but more than nearly 40% of the prison population. This is fucking incredible. Now, the writer Gary Young for The Guardian, he was their reporter here in the U.S. for many years. He said that knowing and understanding something simply does not provide the same intensity as having it in your life. Now, I have 3 boys. 1 has spent time behind bars for a drug-related violation. So I have it in my life. and it's intense. It's so intense that I am oftentimes reminded of the words of my favorite writer, James Baldwin, when he said, to be a Negro scientist, he didn't say scientist, that's me, to be Negro in this country and to be relatively conscious is to be enraged almost all the time. That's my life. That's my life. Now, when you have rage, you have to understand that you have to interact with people who are not responsible for your rage. That's you. And so that helps me to try to do something about the rage with your help. So I'm here asking for your help. Your help in maybe coming up with some solutions about what's going on in our country. It is our country. It's all of our country. And how we want history to judge us. But I have some solutions, or I have some ideas, and I'd like to know what you think about them, and we can have a discussion. One is, make sure you call out racial discrimination. Don't let people get away with saying shit like racial disparities. Call it what it is. Call it out and call out the people who support it. Even if that means you have to check yourself. Work to change the legal status of all drugs, whether it's decriminalizing drugs or legalization. In my book, High Price, I argued that we should decriminalize all drugs like they did in the Czech Republic in the late 1990s, like they did in Portugal in 2001. I no longer believe in that. As a public health professional, I'm more concerned about the adulterants that people get on the street in drugs. Decriminalization does not do anything to ensure quality control of drugs. So the only way I see it now is that we have to regulate drugs so we can control the quality. And we know how to educate about drugs. We know how to keep people safe. This technology is available. As I pointed out, we give these drugs to people every day with your tax dollars. We have that technology is here. But whenever you make a change, a law change or any change in your society, you have to constantly evaluate the risk-benefit ratio of that change. Is the change having more negative consequences than positive, or vice versa? You have to constantly evaluate it and make adjustments accordingly. We have failed to do that in the past 30 or 40 years. And we have to change the narrative about drug users. That's what part of this talk was about, changing the narrative. And changing the narratives, we have to rethink what we think of as a drug user. That's why I made it clear to you that I'm a drug user. I'm a typical drug user. Well, typical drug user is white, but other than that, I am a typical drug user. I'm responsible. Take care of my family. I take care of my bills or what have you. That's the typical drug users. Too often, we see people talking about their drug use who are pathological. That is, they have drug addiction. And when they have drug addictions, they also have other psychiatric or comorbidities. That's not the typical drug user. That's an aberration. So we have to change the narrative. And one way to change the narrative is for people to get out of the closet. It is for responsible people to get out of the closet. And we change the narrative. And finally, you must put the work in. There are no shortcuts. You have to know the science. Otherwise, you get bamboozled. And the society has been getting bamboozled for centuries about drugs. Every week, it seems like there's some new paper out showing some negative or horrible effect. But then when you read the details, even the authors in the papers say that is not as bad as it seems. But nobody reads the papers. All you have to do is read the results. That's all you have to do. And look at some of the methods. And look at the limitations. There's always a limitation section. And the authors tell you that this really doesn't mean what the title says. They tell you this. if you read. Now, I should tell you, what I have laid out here today is not a formula for popularity. This is a formula to be lonely, but you will be right and history will judge you well. And for me, that's far more important than being popular. Because when I have my psychoactive drugs, I don't need you. Thank you.
Should we do questions? Or?
Questions.
Please.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you, bro. Thank you so much for that question. So as we think about heroin, there are two issues that concern me about heroin. I worry about, first, overdose deaths and addiction rates. So when we think about overdose deaths, the vast majority of the people who die from heroin or an opiate have another sedative on board or some other drug on board. And that other drug on board plays a role in causing the respiratory depression. So the major thing that we should be talking about in public in terms of the opioids is we should be telling people, if you're going to use an opiate, do not combine it with another sedative. Do not combine it with an antihistamine. We should be telling people this. And we should also be telling people, if you're using things like Percocet or Vicodin to get high, please be aware that those drugs contain large amounts of acetaminophen, 325 milligrams to 650. Acetaminophen is the number one reason for liver toxicity. So if you need to use an opioid, try to use one without the acetaminophen if you're going to be using large doses. That's one. Now, as we think about addiction rates, about a quarter of the people who use heroin will become addicted. So 75% or so won't become addicted. The people who are most likely to become addicted to heroin are unemployed white males in rural areas. How about we find something for them to do? Work, purpose, meaning in life.
Grow marijuana.
Grow marijuana. And so those are the major issues. And so when people start talking about heroin and the overdoses and those sorts of things, ask those questions. Were there any other drugs involved? Was acetaminophen taken? All of those kinds of things helps us to help our public. Thank you.
I'd like to personally thank Dr. Porter. This is a part of our garden that doesn't get pollinated very often. That was delightful. Thank you so much.
This may be his phone.